The National Archives podcast series, Researching Untold Histories. Black people in England and Wales during the period of the British slave trade, circa 1660 to 1807. Presented by Dr. Kathleen Chater, as part of our Writer of the Month series of talks.
Well, now, I got into this in rather an odd way. I'm not an academic. My background is, I worked in television, as I say, and I did television research, I did training for the television companies. I've written books about doing research for television, which is very, very different from academic research. What we are mainly interested in television is finding people who illustrate some problem or some issue. But academics work from formulating an issue and then finding people to illustrate it. So my way of approaching things is really slightly different. I'm not terribly interested in formulating theories because I think theories should grow from the research you do. So that's my background. And I actually came to this subject through family history. As well as researching for television, I did family history. You know, I'm like a stick of rock, cut me anywhere, and researcher is written there. So when I was doing some work on part of my family history, I discovered this census return, 1851. I knew that one of my ancestors had been a publican, Jonathan Bell. He's the guy on top. I knew he was a publican, and when finally London Metropolitan Archives got round to cataloguing some publicans' licences, I could look up where he kept the pub and find him in the census. I have to say, before I go any further, all this was before all those wonderful online things. I did all this on film. With some printed indexes, not many. Computers in those days were large, clunky, and there was just so little. I can't tell you how little there was online for us family historians. So finally, I tracked him down using film in keeping a pub near the Elephant and Castle. And I wanted to find out where he was born. And what did I find? All he managed to say was that he was a British subject. He and his wife and his children were all British subjects. I can't tell you how annoying that is to a family historian. So I sat there, and as you do, I swung the film backwards and forwards, going backwards and forwards, in the hope that I'd go back to it and find he'd written something different. It doesn't happen like that. What I did notice, though, that this is a very poor part of London. There were a lot of people very nearby who had been born in the West Indies, been born in the Caribbean. And I wondered, I thought, could he have been black? Because that was why he had put British subjects. Usually the Irish were quite happy to put Irish and things like that. He's in a poor area, so his neighbours are not, rich plantation owners retired on their ill-gotten gains. Was he, I wondered, keeping a pub that black people particularly frequented? So I thought I'd have a look about this, and there wasn't very much in those days about tracing Caribbean ancestry. So I read the various books on the subject, books written by academics. And I'm not here to slag off academics, although that's always fun to do. But I was really rather horrified by them. They would take, you know, one example of a person who had had a bad time and then say that everybody had a bad time. Most of the books were written in the early 1970s, and those of you who remember that period will know Marxism was really, really fashionable. Everybody had a very hard time. So I read these books, and they were talking of black people as slaves in Britain, as stigmatised outsiders, as hated, as victims. And they were mainly depending, for examples of this, on America, saying that lynching happened in America, so it probably happened here. I don't think anybody actually said that, but the assumption was that people were stigmatised because of their colour. Now, because I've been a family historian and I've been tracing my own ancestry for about 30 years, I had seen black people come up fairly frequently in the ordinary records. In fact, as it happens, my London ancestors, about half of my ancestors are London, one of them is buried in the same pauper's grave as a black person. So there was no separation, there was no distinction between the two. And although this was actually something that a lot of academics recognised, they did mention that you can't always tell colour or origin from a record. They didn't have any curiosity as to why, and I realised why later. So that's the background. I thought, actually, there might be a little newspaper article or magazine article in this. The fact that the academics had, in fact, I realised, not done anything like enough research. They had, I just thought, actually, I really better sort of clarify this. The English slave trade theoretically started in 1562 when John Hawkins started to make slave trading journeys to Africa. But they weren't very successful and it all died down. Between 1680 and 1672, various companies were formed to trade with Africa, mainly in respectable goods, but we suspect that a few people bought slaves from Africa. That was how some of them came back to England. In fact, a friend of mine is working on that period. She does the Tudors and Stuarts, and I do, from about 1660, when serious slave trading started, or at least it started in a more systematic way. And then, of course, in 1672, the founding of the Royal African Company to regulate the English trade started, and they ended their monopoly in 1698. So that's really the sort of background to this. And again, the assumption that black people in England were slaves was always made. There was also another source, of course. There's very little distinction in the records between people from the East, people from India, and people from Africa. They're both called black or blackamoor in records. So some of the people, of course, would have been from the East Indies rather than Africa. And that started in 1600 with the charter to the East India Company, which had trade with all of, not just India, but China, the whole of East Asia, Asia and East Asia. And that was until 1858. So those are the sort of dates and the sort of outline that I discovered. What we did see, actually, what I did see in all the books that I read were the sort of stereotypes. The assumption that all the black people were servants, for example. These page boys, this kind of painting gets a lot of publicity. Here we have one of the mistresses of Charles II with the page boy. We know from Pepys's diary that various people had black page boys. They were a symbol, a status symbol. And interestingly, he's offering her a bowl of pearls, which were a symbol of purity. So I think the artist here is having a bit of a joke as she's his mistress. Alternatively, the academics thought they were beggars. This is a fairly famous beggar. He was a merchant seaman. He had been injured and therefore couldn't work. He was a sailor and he made his money. He's got a model of Nelson's ship on his head and he went round singing patriotic songs. So, as I say though, mainly servants to the upper classes. Or page boys, the sweet little lad, decorated. And also the faithful servant. This is a gravestone in Bristol. Here lieth the body of Scipio Africanus, Negro servant of the Right Honourable Charles William, Earl of Suffolk, da-da-da-da-da. So all these, again, were given great emphasis in academic works. The assumption that all black people here were servants or sailors. And the other one who got a lot of prominence was, of course, Ola de Equiano, or Gustavus Vassa, the African. And he, of course, wrote his his interesting narrative, his autobiography, which is really, really good. I do advise you just to read it because it is actually brilliant. It's also, nobody ever uses it for this. When I read it, I realised that it's really fascinating about the condition for everybody on board English ships at that time. He's a really, really interesting writer. I do recommend it. Now, he is, of course, the hero of the academics because he wrote against the slave trade, because he was, you know, very, very politically concerned. And, of course, and the others who did get rounded up fairly regularly were Ignatius Sancho. Again, his letters are worth reading because they're good fun. He was a greengrocer in Whitehall after he'd been a butler to the Duke of somewhere or other. And then Francis Barber, of course, got a lot of prominence because he was Dr. Johnson's servant and then his heir. The other ones who, again, got mentioned all the time were Robert Wedderburn and William Cuffey, who were political figures. As I say, all these books that I read were written in the 1970s. So there was a kind of assumption that if you weren't politically involved, you weren't of any interest at all. The emphasis was always on the exceptional and on published sources. Very, very little research was done on original sources, apart from Peter Fryer's book Staying Power, which is still, you know, very good. As I say, I thought I would write a little article about this, about ordinary black people, like my ancestor. I'm not sure about his, you know, his origin, but this was what actually started me off. So I started to collect references. And in 6 months, I had several hundred. I collected them on index cards. This is the typical index card. It's got the guy's name, Thomas Williams. It's got his baptism, the 5th of May, 1638, in St. Olave Hart Street. And it just says a blackamoor. And that is about as much as the majority of things give you. The name, the date, the event, the place, and the description. And so I started to collect them. And I was astonished to find that no one had actually done this before. That all these books were making very, very confident statements about black people in England. They were this, they were that, they were the other. But nobody had actually thought to do any, you know, sort of proper research on this. And as I say, in about 6 months, I had several hundred references. I got these mainly from the Library of the Society of Genealogists in London. I went in whenever I had a couple of hours or on Saturdays when it's open and things like that. And I found them very, very quickly because I started with the obvious parishes where the rich lived. So I was influenced by the books to a large extent, thinking that they were all going to be servants. So I started with Richmond, loads in Richmond, Twickenham, all that sort of, you know, sort of places. And then I moved on a bit more systematically. I went through every county. I went through different sizes and types of settlements, the cities, the towns, market towns, villages. And I think I had, by the end of 6 months, I had 600. And I had started to see a pattern. I wrote an article for the Genealogist magazine about this because I had realised why some people are labelled, mentioned as black, and some weren't. And this was to do with the poor laws. The poor laws were an incredibly complicated system of deciding who was entitled to what would now be called benefits. Who had the responsibility of supporting someone who was old or ill or could not work in some way. And you gained settlement, the right to benefit in a parish, because it was administered at the local level by local parishes, through being born there, through working there and being paid for a year, or through completing an apprenticeship there, or through fulfilling various parish offices, parish duties. And I realised, in fact, that the minute people got settlement, they had worked for a year, they'd been paid for a year, colour wasn't mentioned. That was the point at which it dropped out. And I wrote this article for the Genealogist magazine because, and I do think this is my great contribution to English history writing, because I realised it has such implications for not just black people, but for all migrant groups. I've got Huguenot ancestry, and I tested this on my Huguenot ancestors, and that was exactly the same. The records stopped mentioning it at the point where they'd been in England and been employed and been paid and could support themselves for a year. So that was, as I say, the article I wrote. And I was astonished how many people, then family historians, wrote back to me. One, they said they realised it was true because of their own German, Italian, Russian, whatever ancestors. But loads of others sent me references from all sorts of places. And there were people who had been saving these for years because they were interested but didn't know what to do with them. So there I was, sat there, and I thought, I've got to do something about this in a vague way. And then I decided to widen my search, having realised why the births, you know, the parish registers, the limitations of them with the settlement laws. I then moved on to look in other records. I looked in newspapers, I looked in diaries, I looked in the IGI, the Mormons International Genealogical Index. Adult baptisms in there are usually quite a good clue. And I also fed in keywords into catalogues. If you put black into the average catalogue, you will get too many and too confusing responses to be any use. So I put in Negro, and I put in some of the names that I had found, Caesar, Scipio, that sort of thing. And what that produced, I looked it up in what was then a printed index, was the will of a John Scipio of St. Dunstan Stepney. And here it is. This was in the days, again, when you had to go through them on film in the National Archives, as it was then. No, it wasn't. It was the Public Record Office then. Anyway, I found this will, and he left a serious amount of money. He was a servant. He was working. He was the servant of Elizabeth Snelgrave and William Snelgrave. Now, actually, I already knew from reading that William Snelgrave was a slave trader. So what we have here is the will of the black slave of a slave trader who seemed perfectly happy with his lot and who left a serious amount of money, a lot more than my contemporary ancestor at that time was an upholsterer, and he left considerably less money. So he left a lot here to various people, and he seemed perfectly happy with his lot. However, I thought from his name, John Scipio, I thought he has to be black, but I couldn't prove it. There's no mention of it in the will. There's no mention of him in William Snelgrave's published work about his voyages in the slave trade. So I looked up William Snelgrave's will, again, lots and lots of sort of turning the wheels, and I found it. I found the word in there. William Snelgrave, in fact, the William Snelgrave that John Scipio mentions is his son. William Snelgrave, the elder, the slave trader, had died about 16 years before John Scipio. And he wrote in his will, William Snelgrave, "I have had for many years a black man named Scipio, whom I bought at Jacquin on the coast of Guinea." And at that point I went, yes, very quietly. And the chap next to me turned around and went, because, you know, we researchers. Anyway, and at that point, I thought, I have found someone, the servant of a slave trader, who had money, who was happy with his lot as a servant. I thought, I've got more. I actually wrote an article about it for History Today and got a fair amount of correspondence following that as well. And I knew at that point that I had a thesis, or at least I had a book. And the best way to do that was to write a thesis. So that was the point at which I signed up. I mainly wanted to write the book, but I knew that I wouldn't get it published without some sort of backing, and I needed help to write it. So I signed on with Goldsmiths, And the first thing I did was to, with my several hundred, set up a database. And these were the fields that I ended up with: the name, the date of the event, the type of the event, you know, birth, baptism, marriage, inquest, newspaper report, all sorts of things, age of the person, the place where it the event happened, the description of the person, which is quite interesting, their occupation, and the place of origin. So I could, you know, separate them out. And this was a sort of beginning of this. And after some thought and a lot of consideration, I decided that my thesis would answer this question. I knew from working in television, I know a television programme, you have to formulate the question to be answered, because then all the research that doesn't relate to it falls away. It makes it much, much easier. You can change the question later on if it's worth it, but if you just sit there and sort of faff around, you know, you don't go anywhere, and your research just goes off in lots of different directions. So that was my question. I also decided to limit to the period. As you see from the card I got from 1638, I was actually looking at everything to start with, and it was just too huge. There were just far too many periods to examine, and that because the society changes over the years, I decided to limit it to the period of the slave trade, because I was still quite interested then on the attitudes of the British population to people of African origin, people of Asian origin, while slavery was such an important component of the economy. And it was such a political, of such political importance. So I thought I wanted to see what people's attitude to people was at that time. Now, when I was doing this as well, I started to examine in some detail, with some care, the actual wording of items that I found. This one's particularly interesting, because here we have a child called Hannah Norbrook being baptised in Suffolk. This is rural Suffolk. This is miles from the slave trade. How did the family pitch up here? We don't know. But this is the thing: daughter of Henry Norbrook, a Negro, and Hannah, his wife. And there was a note at the bottom of the page: the registry of Henry Norbrook as a Negro may assist some future person in observing how long time the colour wears out by marrying with white men or women, Hannah being his first child. I thought that was rather sweet and rural. They were just, you know, they were just astonished. And I noted later on that there were other children of the same parents baptised, and I don't think they mentioned colour at all. That's the only reason that it was put in, because the guy was interested in seeing. I mean, this seems to us now so ridiculous, because we are all so used to a multiracial, multicultural society. But if you look at a place like Suffolk in 1761, I mean, the roads weren't very good. People didn't go there. It was just a very small rural area. So I did this, and I got interested at this point as well. I started a children's database, because I realised fairly quickly when I tried to put them into my main database that what is interesting here is that the colour of the child is not mentioned. The colour of the child is only once mentioned that I have found. It is always the parent, usually the father, but sometimes the mother. Now, that has all sorts of implications, because, of course, in a society where it matters legally whether you are black, white, brown, what your racial origin is and what proportion of it is from which area, then it's important to label the child. But this never happened, except in one instance that I can think of. And in fact, most of the time, children are simply baptised with no mention at all. All Ignatius Sancho's six children, there's no mention of his colour. If he hadn't published his book, we would simply think that he was actually, we probably think he was Spanish and living in Westminster, because there's no mention of colour in any of the baptism, or in fact of his marriage. And so I started to reconstruct family trees, because I was quite interested to see at what point you stopped mentioning that the person was black or white or whatever. And here's the Norbrook family tree. But you see, all of those I found through baptism records, through census returns and things like that. And after Henry, nothing is mentioned. And that, again, is pretty standard. It's only the first generation where colour or ethnic origin is mentioned. I should add, actually, this was what I was always interested in doing. But my supervisor said I had to do a lot of statistical analysis from my database. So I did, about where people came from and all the rest of it. But this was what I really enjoyed, the sort of reconstructing it to see what people's lives were like. Here's a marriage, actually. This is the marriage in the middle here of John Cranbrook and Anne Wallace. This was in the City of London. As you see, no mention of colour. I found this quite a long time after. What I first of all found, John Cranbrook is baptised as a child in Rochester in Kent. And then I find him, I found his burial in Clapham in Surrey, and I knew it was the same person because the dates matched up, you know, and I already had them on the database. This was very useful, being able to compare people. And so then, of course, I could look for the marriage. And here I find it. And here he is with his lovely flourishing signature. He's put that in there. He was literate. He was, you know, his wife was also literate. And then I reconstructed his family tree. You can see how many descendants he left. And it's only in his burial that mentions he's a mulatto. His baptism said he was black. His burial says he's a mulatto. He was a greengrocer. He died at 42 in Clapham. Now, those of you who've done some work on this will know of the Clapham sect, who were very active in the abolition of the slave trade at this period. I just like the idea that they were buying their fruit and veg from John, that they were showing a bit of solidarity and support. Anyway, this is the more formally sort of drawn up one. That's an example of the kind of thing that I would work from. Now, as you see, there are descendants, various ones and descendants. Also, what I haven't got here, Rebecca married a man named William Gregory, and she has left an enormous number of descendants, some of whom are in the audience today. It gives you an idea, I think, of just how much a part of everyday life people were at this time. I'm pretty certain, actually, that all of these, I'm assuming, I haven't found their baptisms, but I have found various children being registered in nonconformist church. They're registered in Dr. Williams' library. So I suspect, although they married in the Church of England, John and Anne were nonconformists and probably attended a church whose records, unfortunately, haven't survived. But I have found the others in Clapham. So I'm not quite sure of the background to this. This one, William, he left an enormous number of children. And I can trace them down to the 1871 census, but there were just so many of them, and they were all calling their children by the same name, so I've got a bit lost there. I'm going to need someone to do something about it. But Rebecca, who married William Gregory, she left a number of children. As I say, some are here today, some are in Australia. So they spread all over the world. Oh, yes, and there's a small branch who wound up in Hong Kong, but then came back to England. Here is the will of John's wife, born Anne Wallace. And she left everything to her daughter, Rebecca. I don't know why, particularly. She was such a favourite. You know, there's some interesting things there. And then we have one of the sons, John, who left money and all the rest of it. And he calls himself a gentleman. So I suspect that John Cranbrook did quite well out of his business, because his children, his descendants, did quite well for themselves. The youngest one, James, I don't know what he did for a living, but this one, this James, became a minister. He was a Presbyterian, well, no, an independent minister, And he had a really, really fascinating career. I'm not going to go on about it, but I'm just going to give you some sort of background, because it's the kind of story that interests me about people, about how they came to do this, how he came to be the grandchild of what was obviously started out as a servant and then a shopkeeper. He became an independent minister. He was also professor of English literature at Queen's College in Liverpool at one stage. In the 1861 census, that's where he's mentioned. His children, the first three were born in Suffolk, then there were one or two in Ireland, then back to Staffordshire, and then Cheshire. A bit later, he started out his career in Stratford-upon-Avon as an independent minister. He then became a pastor in Edinburgh, the Albany Street Congregational Church. There were questions about his beliefs. He resigned in 1867, and he asked Thomas Henry Huxley, who's an agnostic, to preach to his congregation. This caused an enormous uproar. You can find a huge amount about it on the internet, you know, because it was such a big and important issue for people at that time. Anyway, I'm not going to go on any more about that, although, as I say, that is really what I do find interesting. Here's a burial. Buried in St George in the East, which is Wapping. A black man by coroner's warrant. And again, that was something that surprised me, that you would have a coroner's inquest on someone treated exactly the same as everyone else. I don't know why it surprised me when I started up this, but you did find that black people were treated exactly the same as the general population. And I'm deliberately using the word black here because there is no differentiation made between people of African origin and people of Indian origin. That was the term that was used at the time. That was what people understood. Here's an adult baptism. John Williams. I discovered, actually, that John Williams is the most common name for a black person in England during the 18th century. This is a nightmare for us family historians. It is really, really difficult to find them. But this is rather nice because it says, it gives you his place of birth, it tells you his age. He was baptised at his own earnest request and in the presence of George England, David Jones and Mary Berry, his chosen witnesses, his sponsors, his godparents. And then I've noted identical wording to later adult baptism of what I presume was a white man, because there's no difference in the wording. And that was one of the things that I found very, very important, to see what was normal for everybody at that time, not just to cherry pick a mention of a black person and assume it applied to everybody. You had to see what the individual quirks were of the person making the record. So going through these things, it took me actually about 2.5 years to set up the actual database that I used. And it took me a long time, and it was only after that that I could start to see the significance of what it was showing. Anyway, so that was this was interesting because you often found people assuming that black people had been forcibly baptised, you know, that they were dragged kicking and screaming to the font. Now, this is just not true. It's quite interesting, though, that there is a difference between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. In Roman Catholicism at that period, people were baptised even before they knew what they were doing. This is why there were all these mass baptisms in South America, for example, because you became a member of the Roman Catholic Church by being baptised and then agreeing to do all the things, you know, acceding to all the sort of the tenets of the religion, of learning about them after you were baptised. However, in Protestantism, you had to know what you were signing up for. You had to know what you were agreeing to do. So this was quite an important thing, and the difference between, you know, baptism for Roman Catholics. And it was often assumed, you see, that Roman Catholics baptised people of African and Indian origin much more readily than the Protestants did. You occasionally find mention in, again, of these saying, after being instructed in the faith. And these are all the sort of Church of England things. So I just, again, this is another thing that I think was quite important in looking at the status of people and their position at this time. The other thing, I mean, I'd seen all the sort of the early visual representations, which I showed you. I did start, but I didn't go on because it didn't really hang into the sort of question that I was answering. But I did start to look at ordinary black people in prints. This is Hogarth. It's noon. Actually, what he's doing there, he's satirising these people who are French. This is the French church. Here he uses, David Dabadine makes a very good case for Hogarth's use. His book is called Hogarth's Blacks. His use of them as natural, the early sort of noble, not noble savage exactly, but natural people, unconstrained by the trammels of civilization and things like that. But much more interesting, I think, are the ones where you simply, if you look at almost any 18th century print of London, you will see black faces in the crowd. Here we have the Westminster Pit. What is obviously going on is some kind of illegal dogfight, because there's the guy looking at the, through the door, keeping watch. And yet you have here two people who are definitely of African origin representation. And yet, what do you see? They're not there out of any sense of political correctness, because the concept didn't exist at that time. That is what a London crowd looks like. And here we are in the East End of London. This is The Adventures of Tom and Jerry. It's slightly outside my period. It's a bit later. Tom and Jerry was a really, really popular book. I can't tell you how popular it was. But it described the peregrinations of this couple, Tom and Jerry, being shown round London, the high life and the low life. And here we have, it's called All Max in the East, which is obviously a pun on All Max, the great club for upper class people in the West End of London. This is All Max in the East. And these characters were so popular that they actually had there was a stage play, there were little china objects made of them. And if you can find any of these china ornaments now, they are worth a fortune. So keep an eye out for them. But as you see, simply part of the crowd generally. And then in this one, again, part of the crowd, the Piccadilly Nuisance, satirising traffic conditions in Piccadilly, which shows you some things never change. But right in the left-hand corner, there is a man who is obviously a butler, and the small child next to him, the errand boy, is probably black as well. They are simply part of the crowd. So as I say, I started to look at those because I thought that was quite an interesting thing, the representation, but it didn't really relate to the question that I was asking about people, the average person's experience. Where I did find the most interesting thing that showed you so much about everyday life was, oddly enough, in the crimes. I went through the Old Bailey online. If you haven't discovered this, you have to discover it now. It is the most riveting thing. It is transcripts of all the trials at the Old Bailey from, I can't remember, 16-something or other, up to about 1913. And they are transcripts, what people actually said. Most of them, the early ones, aren't. Anyway, as I say, this was before they had put this on. They had put this online. I'd started my thesis in 2000. It was about the point at which they were thinking about putting this online. So I did it the hard way. I went through 10,000 trials on film in the Guildhall. It took me, I mean, obviously I didn't read every one, every word of every one. It took me about 3 months of quite hard work, and I missed some, which I've been able to pick up from the online database now. There were benefits to that, though. instead of just going through and picking people out, because I was reading or at least glancing at everyone, I saw what was normal for everyone else. I saw how the Irish were treated, how Jews were treated, how the various Italians, French, Germans, Swedish who pitched up there were treated. And so that was quite, you know, that was very salutary and it was deeply fascinating. Anyway, as I say, I pulled out, I did my own crime database, the name, the dates of the event, of trial, the crime, what role the black person played in this. Were they the defendant, the prosecutor, the witness? Were they mentioned as being present or what it was? What was the verdict? Were they recommended to mercy or were they what was called discretion? The jury could actually minimise the crime. Over 40 shillings was a felony and you could be the most severe punishments. You could be transported for that. Below that, it was a misdemeanour. And very often, the jury would undervalue something. They would say that you were guilty of the crime, but it was not worth as much as the person said. They would reduce it. That's called exercising discretion. So I looked at that, and then the sentence, and what the outcome was. If they were sentenced to death, were they hanged? If they were sentenced to be transported, were they transported, and things like that. I couldn't always sort of fill that in. But that was quite interesting. Two things came out of that. Remarkably few black people showed up at the Old Bailey. It was really sad. You know, I went through 10,000 trials. There's only about 130 max that involved black people in some way. Mind you, it was an interesting thing to do. I enjoyed doing it. And I entered all these people on the main database as well. But what did come out of it, even the thing that I could then do once the Old Bailey online was there, you can extract statistical information from it. So I could see how compared to the main body of people, it was that the black people were hanged, for example, how likely they were to be have their sentence reduced and things like that. And I actually found that, broadly speaking, they were treated exactly the same as everybody else. All the verdicts were the, you know. I think 24 or 25 were sentenced to death. I haven't been able to find out about a couple of them. The generally accepted figure is that a third of the people who were sentenced to death were actually executed. And that is precisely what happened. Eight black people were executed out of the 24 or 25. So that's precisely the same number. I was quite interested in that. Anyway, so that was the other thing I did. But of course, crime then lent... let me just tell you about the crimes, because, again, the statistical stuff is a bit boring, but actually the details of what they did. Now, this is probably the commonest crime committed both by black people and against black people. These two ladies of, how shall we put this, negotiable virtue, are going to take that sailor to a pub. They are going to make him pay for a lot of drink. He is going to get very, very drunk, and then they're going to rob him. And that is the most common crime. It's, you know, there's a woman, if you want to look her up, there's a woman called Anne Duck. I've written about her for the Oxford, the ODNB, you know, the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography. She's online because she is the black person who makes the most appearances at the Old Bailey. She makes six or seven appearances. She's let off every time, except for the last one, and she is hanged. Mind you, they probably thought she's just not going to learn her lesson, is she? Anyway, this was her crime. This was what she did. She got away with a lot of others as well. One of the girls she worked with, they always worked in pairs or threes. Actually, it was on her conscience that one of the people they robbed died. And they just dragged the body away and left it somewhere to be discovered. So, you know. Anyway, that is the most common committed one. Another interesting one was the Gordon riots. We know of three black people who were involved in the Gordon riots. A girl called Charlotte Gardner and two men called Benjamin Bosie and I've forgotten the other one. It'll come to me in a minute. Anyway, they were all sentenced to death for their part in this. The Gordon riots, a bit like Tottenham, actually. You know, Tottenham recently, although it was actually an anti-Catholic thing set off by Lord Gordon. Anyway, it was an anti-Catholic thing, but people just took advantage of it to loot and to steal and all the rest of it. Anyway, three of them were sentenced to death. Charlotte Gardner actually was hanged because she didn't have anyone to speak up for her. The other two had been servants, and their ex-masters, they contacted their ex-masters, who went to an enormous amount of trouble and effort to get them pardoned. You will see sometimes that they were hanged in books because people haven't followed this up. But someone that in the Black and Asian Studies Association that I know followed this up, and an article was published in History Today about this, showing the efforts that they made. Again, I thought that was interesting because they were, by this time, they had left service. They weren't working for these people anymore. But they still had an obligation towards them. One of them said that he's just a silly lad, he's just easily led, you know. And so I thought that was quite nice that they would actually, you know, stand up for them. And another case, that's another thing there. You can actually see someone black in the crowd. This is a close-up of one of the prints from the Gordon riots. And there's another one outside London, just to show that they weren't just Londoners. This is one of mine. A guy called Richard Small. I need to find out about him, but there's just so many to follow up. As you see, he was acquitted at the August Assizes. It's going to be in, this was PRO when I was doing this, it's now the National Archives. It's going to be somewhere on the Oxford Circuit to follow up the trial. It's just in my big file of things I need to do something about sometime, you know. And there is a print of the jail. You can see this online, but it isn't, I'm afraid. The reproduction isn't good enough to show you. You can actually see him, that he was actually in jail when someone took a sketch of an escape that was made by someone else. Someone did a sketch of it, and he actually happened to be in there at the same time. And then we come on again, not to the criminals, but to those giving evidence. In the colonies in America and in the Caribbean, black people could not give evidence against white. But here we have, this is quite a famous case, this is a case of Captain John Sutherland, who stabbed his cabin boy, killed him. And the major witness against him, in fact, the witness at the trial against him, on whose evidence he was hanged, is Jack Thompson, the mate, who happens to be black, of African origin. And I mean, that's quite a significant thing, that he was, that John Sutherland was hanged on his evidence, effectively. I moved on there to the sort of the legal cases because of the consideration of slavery in England. The assumption was, in most places, and in fact still is for some people, that the black people in England were slaves. There was a lot of misunderstanding about this. Granville Sharp brought the first case, Jonathan Strong. I've written this up for the DNB as well, so you can check out the Jonathan Strong case there. He brought the first case to challenge the right of slave owners from the colonies. Jonathan Strong was brought to England by an American. He was his slave. And there were several other cases. That one wasn't settled properly. The Granville Sharp case wasn't settled very well. The first case, the Jonathan Strong case, wasn't settled very well. And then 1772, the Mansfield judgment in the case of James Somerset was really the, you know, the clinching thing. Now, this one is still sort of argued over. On the National Archives website, there is the actual judgment in the case. At the time, it wasn't considered terribly important. No one was actually in the court taking it down. It had to be reconstructed later from, you know, Mansfield's notes, effectively. There are several versions of it. And so the one that's generally accepted and is, you know, English law, still English law, is on the National Archives website. And when I looked at this, I read it properly, it was always assumed that people had just, you know, let James Somerset go, you know, and that it ended slavery in Britain. But if you actually read it, you find that Mansfield says that slavery never existed in Britain. There is no law against it. And without law against it, there can, you know, this, there wasn't a case for it. And I discussed this to make sure I got it right with a friend of mine who's a solicitor. And she had done it as part of her legal training, the Mansfield judgment, because this is, she said, it's nothing to do with slavery. What it's to do with is the limit of English law. English law did not apply in the colonies. The colonies formulated their own. But when people from the colonies came to England, then English law applied to them. This was actually different, I've since discovered, in France. France had the same law in metropolitan France as overseas, and they had special arrangements for slaves being brought to France to remain slaves. This was never necessary in England because each colony made its own laws. But when you moved between them, you didn't retain the sort of, if you came from America, as it was then a British colony, the laws that applied to you in America did not apply to you in England, which was the cause of the confusion. Anyway, so I had a look at this, and as I say, I did it with a friend of mine, and again, it questions the assumption that so many academics had made without actually reading the judgment or looking at it properly as to what it actually said. And there, of course, just to show you, is the sort of the famous Dido and Elizabeth, who were Lord Mansfield's great nieces. This is the picture from Kenwood House, where he lived in England. Now, recently, loads of other people have started to do this. We have started to get away from the sort of assumption that, black people were stigmatised outsiders, they were slaves and all the rest of it. And here we have some work. This chap wasn't discovered until fairly recently. Nathaniel Wells of Piercefield was the under-sheriff of Monmouthshire. And so no one had thought he was going to be anything other than white and upper class. In fact, he was the son of a plantation owner by a slave mother who had been given an enormous amount of money as a young man. He came to England, he bought Piercefield House, which he loved. There was an article about it in the Telegraph recently. It's a really, really beautiful house. It was admired at the time. People loved it. He married twice, had umpteen children. He was, as I say, under-sheriff of Monmouthshire. He was a JP. And what I think is actually slightly more important to show his status in the community, he was master of the foxhounds. You know, that the local upper class were letting him run the local hunt, which was, I think, actually slightly more important than being a JP in many ways, so at least locally. And there he is, all his descendants. I'm in touch with a collateral branch of this lot. But you see, he wasn't discovered because his colour is nowhere mentioned except in a private diary. And it was someone who actually saw this in a private diary who then did all this work on him. So more and more people are being discovered. Here is Joseph Emedy. He was a musician who was brought from Portugal to Cornwall, where he became really, really important in Cornish musical life. And he was discovered by somebody who was writing a book about music in Cornwall, you see. He was interested in the music society in Cornwall. And he discovered Emedy while he was doing this. So this is an interesting shift of focus, of looking at black people within their society, not as outsiders, as, you know, exceptional or in some way stigmatised. And, of course, we've got the rest of us, the descendants of black people. This is Dennis Barber with a portrait of his ancestor, Francis Barber. So this is the great sort of discovery, I think, that we're making, that so many of us today may well have black ancestors that we know nothing about, because they're not regarded as any way exceptional in their area, and their sort of status isn't passed down. As I think, there is a great, great deal more to do. I have now got a database of some 5,000 people, which is probably about a third of the total number who were in, you know, Britain up to the beginning of the 19th century. And there is just such a huge amount to do. Each individual person takes about a week to research, to reconstruct their lives, to reconstruct their descendants and things. So you do the maths, as they say. I've got 5,000 on there. I need some help. Once we've done this, we will be able, we should be able to discover, we'll be able to do a lot of sort of statistical stuff. I'm quite heavily influenced by the Cambridge group for population and whatever, social structure, to see how different their age at marriage was, how different their age at death was, the number of children they have. And I'm particularly interested in mobility, both geographic mobility and social mobility, because of the comparison, I think, that we can then make with other societies. I'm getting quite interested in Europe, in France, and to see what the sort of differences and the similarities are to do with the slave trades. Thank you very much.
This talk was recorded on the 8th of October 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This talk was sponsored by the Friends of the National Archives. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.